Okay, 12. Keep your voices down. People are sleeping. No one is going to hire you on at the fair. What they're going to do is slam you in the dollar jail on whatever excuse they've got for a midway and keep you there until your parents show up. Until they do, folks are going to come by and gawk at you. Some may throw peanuts or pork rinds. The Bilson twins stared at him with dismay and perhaps some relief. Here's what you do, Tim said. You go on back home right now, and I'll walk behind you, just to make sure you don't change your collective mind.
What's a collective mind?
Robert asked. A thing twins are reputed to have, at least according to folklore. Did you use the door or go out a window? Window, Roland said. Okay, that's how you go back in. If you're lucky, your folks will never know you were out. Robert.
You won't tell them?
Not unless I see you try it again, Tim said. Then I'll not only tell them what you did, I'll tell them about how you sassed me when I caught you. Roland shocked.
We didn't do no such thing.
I'll lie, Tim said. I'm good at it. He followed them and watched as Robert Bilson made a step with his hands to help Roland into the open window. Tim then did Robert the same favor. He waited to see if a light would go on somewhere, signaling imminent discovery of the would-be runaways. And when none did, he resumed his rounds. 13. There were more people out and about on Friday and Saturday nights, at least until midnight or 1 in the morning. Courting couples, mostly. After that, there might be an invasion of what Sheriff John called the road rockets. Young men in souped-up cars or trucks who went blasting down Dupre's empty Main Street at 60 or 70 miles an hour, racing side by side and waking people up with the ornery blat of their glass-pack mufflers. Sometimes a deputy or an SP trooper would run one of them down and write him up, or jail him if he blew 09. But even with 4 Dupre officers on duty during weekend nights, arrests were relatively rare. Mostly, they got away with it. Tim went to see Orphan Annie. He found her sitting outside her tent, knitting slippers. Arthritis or not, her fingers moved like lightning. He asked if she'd like to make $20. Annie said a little money always came in handy, but it would depend on what the job was. He told her, and she cackled.
Happy to do it, Mr. J, if you throw in a couple of bottles of Wickles, that is.
Annie, whose motto seemed to be go big or go home, made him a banner 30 feet long and 7 feet wide. Tim attached it to a steel roller he made himself, welding together pieces of pipe in the shop of Fromey's Small Engine Sales and Service. After explaining to Sheriff John what he wanted to do and receiving permission to give it a try, Tim and Tag Faraday hung the roller on a cable above Main Street's three-way intersection, anchoring the cable to the false fronts of Oberg's Drug on one side and the defunct movie theater on the other. On Friday and Saturday nights, around the time the bars closed, Tim yanked a cord that unfurled the banner like a window shade. On either side, Annie had drawn an old-fashioned flash camera. The message beneath read, "Slow down, idiot. We are photographing your license plate." They were doing no such thing, of course, although Tim did note down tag numbers when he had time to make them out. But Annie's banner actually seemed to work. It wasn't perfect, but what in life was? In early July, Sheriff John called Tim into his office. Tim asked if he was in trouble.
"Just the opposite," Sheriff John said. "You're doing a good job. That banner thing sounded crazy to me. But I have to admit that I was wrong and you were right. It was never the midnight drag races that bothered me, anyway, nor the folks complaining that we were too lazy to put a stop to it. The same people, mind you, who vote down a law enforcement payroll increase year after year. What bothers me are the messes we have to clean up when one of those stampeders hits a tree or a telephone pole. Dead is bad, but the ones who were never the same after one night of stupid hoorah, I sometimes think they're worse. But June was okay this year. Better than okay. Maybe it was just an exception to the general rule, but I don't think so. I think it's the banner. You tell Annie she might have saved some lives with that one, and she can sleep in one of the back cells any night she wants, once it's cold weather.
I'll do that, Tim said. As long as you keep a stock of Wickles, she'll be there plenty.
Sheriff John leaned back. His chair groaned more despairingly than ever.
When I said you were overqualified for the night knocker job, I didn't know the half of it. We're gonna miss you when you move on to New York.
I'm in no hurry, Tim said.
14. The only business in town that stayed open 24 hours a day was the Zonies Go Mart out by the warehouse complex. In addition to beer, soda, and chips, Zonies sold an off-brand gasoline called Zony Juice. Two handsome Somali brothers, Absamil and Gutali Dobira, alternated on the night shift from midnight to 8. On a dog-hot night in mid-July, as Tim was chalking and knocking his way up the west end of Maine, he heard a bang from the vicinity of Zonies. It wasn't especially loud, but Tim knew a gunshot when he heard one. It was followed by a yell of either pain or anger and the sound of breaking glass. Tim broke into a run, time clock banging against his thigh, hand automatically feeling for the butt of a gun that was no longer there. He saw a car parked at the pumps, and as he approached the convenience store, two young men came charging out, one of them with a handful of something that was probably cash. Tim dropped to one knee, watching as they got into the car and roared away, tires sending up puffs of blue smoke from the oil and grease-stained tarmac. He pulled his walkie from his belt.
Station, this is Tim. Who's there? Come on back to me.
It was Wendy Gullickson, sounding sleepy and put out.
What do you want, Tim?
There's been a 211 at Zonies. A shot was fired.
That woke her up.
Jesus, a robbery? I'll be right there.
No, just listen to me. Two perpetrators, male, white, teens or 20s, compact car, might have been a Chevy Cruze. No way to tell the color under those gas station fluorescents, but late model. North Carolina plate, starts WTB-9, couldn't make out the last three digits. Get it out to whoever's on patrol and the state police before you do anything else.
What are...
He clicked off, reholstered the walkie, and sprinted for the Zonies. The glass front of the counter was trash and the register was open. One of the Dobira brothers lay on his side in a growing pool of blood. He was gasping for breath, each inhale ending in a whistle. Tim knelt beside him.
Gotta turn you on your back, Mr. Dobira.
Please, don't. Hurts.
Tim was sure it did, but he needed to look at the damage. The bullet had gone in high on the right side of Dobira's blue Zonies smock, which was now a muddy purple with blood. More was spilling from his mouth, soaking his goatee. When he coughed, he sprayed Tim's face and glasses with fine droplets. Tim grabbed his walkie again and was relieved that Gullickson hadn't left her post. Need an ambulance, Wendy. Fast as they can make it from Dunning. One of the Dobira brothers is down. Looks like the bullet clipped his lung. She acknowledged, then started to ask a question. Tim cut her off again, dropped his walkie on the floor, and pulled off the t-shirt he was wearing. He pressed it against the hole in Dobira's chest.
Can you hold that for a few seconds, Mr. Dobira?
Hard to breathe.
I'm sure it is. Hold it. It'll help.
Dobira pressed the wadded-up shirt to his chest. Tim didn't think he'd be able to hold it for long, and he couldn't expect an ambulance for at least 20 minutes. Even that would be a miracle. Gas-and-go convenience stores were heavy on snacks but light on first aid supplies. There was Vaseline, however. Tim grabbed a jar, and from the next aisle, a box of Huggies. He tore it open as he ran back to the man on the floor. He removed the t-shirt, now sodden with blood, gently pulled up the equally sodden blue smock, and began to unbutton the shirt Dobira wore beneath.
No, no, no,
Dobira moaned.
Hurts. You don't touch. Please.
Got to.
Tim heard an engine approaching. Blue jackpot light started to spark and dance in the shards of broken glass. He didn't look around. Hang on, Mr. Dobira. He hooked a glob of Vaseline out of the jar and packed it into the wound. Dobira cried out in pain, then looked at Tim with wide eyes.
Can breathe a little better.
This is just a temporary patch, but if your breathing's better, your lung probably didn't collapse. At least not entirely, Tim thought. Sheriff John came in and took a knee next to Tim. He was wearing a pajama top the size of a mainsail over his uniform pants, and his hair was every which way. You got here quick, Tim said.
I was up. Couldn't sleep, so I was making myself a sandwich when Wendy called. Sir, are you Gutali or Absamil?
Absamil, sir.
He was still wheezing, but his voice was stronger. Tim took one of the disposable diapers, still folded up, and pressed it against the wound.
Oh, that is painful.
Was it a through and through, or is it still in there? Sheriff John asked.
I don't know, and I don't want to turn him over again to find out. He's relatively stable, so we just gotta wait for the ambulance. Tim's walkie crackled. Sheriff John plucked it gingerly from the litter of broken glass. It was Wendy.
Tim, Bill Wicklow spotted those guys out on Deep Meadow Road and lit them up.
It's John, Wendy. Tell Bill to show caution. They're armed.
They're down, is what they are.
She might have been sleepy before, but Wendy was wide awake now and sounding satisfied.
They tried to run and ditch their car. One's got a broken arm, the other one's cuffed to the bull bars on Bill's ride. State police are en route. Tell Tim he was right about it being a cruise. How's Dobira?
He'll be fine, Sheriff John said. Tim wasn't entirely sure of that, but he understood that the sheriff had been talking to the wounded man as well as Deputy Gullickson.
I gave the money from the register,
Dobira said.
It is what we are told to do.
He sounded ashamed, even so. Deeply ashamed. That was the right thing, Tim said.
The one with the gun shot me anyway. Then the other one broke in the counter to take...
More coughing. Hush now, Sheriff John said.
To take the lottery tickets,
Absamil Dobira said.
The ones you scratch off. We must have them back. Until bought, they are the property of...
He coughed weakly.
Of the state of South Carolina.
Sheriff John said, Be quiet, Mr. Dobira. Stop worrying about those damn scratchers and save your strength. Mr. Dobira closed his eyes. 15. The next day, while Tim was eating his lunch on the porch at the rail depot, Sheriff John pulled up in his personal vehicle. He mounted the steps and looked at the sagging seat of the other available chair.
Think that'll hold me?
Only one way to find out, Tim said. Sheriff John sat down gingerly.
Hospital says Dobir's gonna be okay. His brother's with him, Gutali, and he says he's seen those two dirtbags before, a couple of times.
They was casing the joint, Tim said.
No doubt. I sent Tag Faraday over to take both brothers' statements. Tag's the best I've got, which I probably didn't need to tell you.
Gibson and Burkett aren't bad. Sheriff John sighed.
No, but neither of them would have moved as fast or as decisively as you did last night. And poor Wendy probably would have just stood there gawking if she didn't faint dead away.
She's good on dispatch, Tim said. Made for the job. Just my opinion, you know.
And a whiz at clerical, reorganized all our files last year, plus got everything on flash drives. But on the road, she's damn near useless. She loves being on the team, though. How would you like to be on the team, Tim?
I didn't think you could afford another cop's salary. Did you all at once get a payroll increase?
Don't I wish. But Bill Wicklow's turning in his badge at the end of the year. I was thinking maybe you and him could swap jobs. He walks and knocks, you put on a uniform and get to carry a gun again. I asked Bill. He says night knocking would suit him, at least for a while.
Can I think about it?
I don't know why not.
Sheriff John stood up.
End of the year is still 5 months away, but we'd be glad to have you.
Does that include Deputy Gullickson? Sheriff John grinned.
Wendy's hard to win over, but you got a long way down that road last night.
Really? And if I asked her out to dinner, what do you think she'd say?
I think she'd say yes. As long as it wasn't Bev's you were thinking of taking her to. Good-looking girl like her is going to expect the roundup in Dunning at the very least. Maybe that Mexican joint down in Hardyville.
Thanks for the tip.
Not a problem. You think about that job.
I will. He did, and was still thinking of it when all hell broke loose on a hot night later that summer. The Smart Kid. 1. On a fine Minneapolis morning in April of that year, Tim Jameson, still months from his arrival in Dupre, Herbert and Eileen Ellis were being ushered into the office of Jim Greer, one of three guidance counselors at the Broderick School for Exceptional Children.
Luke's not in trouble, is he? Eileen asked when they were seated. If he is, he hasn't said anything.
Not at all, Greer said. He was in his 30s, with thinning brown hair and a studious face. He was wearing a sport shirt open at the collar and pressed jeans.
Look, you know how things work here, right?
How things have to work, given the mental capacity of our students. They are graded, but not in grades. They can't be. We have 10-year-olds with mild autism who are doing high school math, but still reading at a third grade level. We have kids who are fluent in as many as 4 languages, but have trouble multiplying fractions. We teach them in all subjects, and we board 90% of them. We have to. They come from all parts of the United States and a dozen or so from abroad. But we center our attention on their special talents, whatever those happen to be. That makes the traditional system, where kids advance from kindergarten to 12th grade, pretty useless to us.
We understand that, Herb said, and we know Luke's a smart kid. That's why he's here.
What he didn't add, certainly Greer knew it, was that they never could have afforded the school's astronomical fees. Herb was the foreman in a plant that made boxes. Eileen was a grammar school teacher. Luke was one of the Broad's few day students, and one of the school's very few scholarship students.
Smart?
Not exactly. Greer looked down at an open folder on his otherwise pristine desk, and Eileen had a sudden premonition. Either they were going to be asked to withdraw their son, or his scholarship was going to be canceled, which would make withdrawal a necessity. Yearly tuition fees at the Broad were $40,000 a year, give or take, roughly the same as Harvard. Greer was going to tell them it had all been a mistake, that Luke wasn't as bright as they'd all believed. He was just an ordinary kid who read far above his level and seemed to remember it all. Eileen knew from her own reading that eidetic memory was not exactly uncommon in young children. Somewhere between 10% and 15% of all normal kids possessed the ability to remember almost everything. The catch was that the talent usually disappeared when children became adolescents, and Luke was nearing that point. Greer smiled.
Let me give it to you straight. We pride ourselves on teaching exceptional children, but we've never had a student at the Broderick quite like Luke.
One of our emeritus teachers, Mr. Flint, now in his 80s, took it on himself to give Luke a tutorial on the history of the Balkans, a complicated subject, but one that casts great light on the current geopolitical situation. So Flint says, anyway. After the first week, he came to me and said that his experience with your son must have been like the experience of the Jewish elders when Jesus not only taught them but rebuked them, saying it wasn't what went into their mouths that made them unclean, but what came out of them.
I'm lost, Herb said.
So was Billy Flint. That's my point.
Greer leaned forward.
Understand me now. Luke absorbed 2 semesters worth of extremely difficult postgraduate work in a single week, and drew many of the conclusions Flint had intended to make once the proper historical groundwork had been laid. On some of those conclusions, Luke argued, and very convincingly, that they were received wisdom rather than original thought. Although, Flint added, he did so very politely, almost apologetically.
I'm not sure how to respond to that, Herb said. Luke doesn't talk much about his schoolwork because he says we wouldn't understand.
Which is pretty much true, Eileen said. I might have known something about the binomial theorem once, but that was a long time ago.
Herb said, when Luke comes home, he's like any other kid. Once his homework's done and his chores, he boots up the Xbox or shoots hoops in the driveway with his friend Rolf. He still watches SpongeBob SquarePants. He considered, then added, although usually with a book in his lap. Yes, Eileen thought. Just lately, Principles of Sociology. Before that, William James. Before that, the AA Big Book. And before that, the complete works of Cormac McCarthy. He read the way free-range cows graze, moving to wherever the grass is greenest. That was a thing her husband chose to ignore, because the strangeness of it frightened him. It frightened her as well, which was probably one reason why she knew nothing of Luke's tutorial on Balkan history. He hadn't told her because she hadn't asked. We have prodigies here, Greer said. In fact, I'd rate well over 50% of the broad student body as prodigies, but they are limited. Luke is different, because Luke is global. It isn't one thing, it's everything. I don't think he'll ever play professional baseball or basketball. If he takes after my side of the family, he'll be too short for pro basketball. Herb was smiling. Unless he's the next Spud Webb, that is.
Hush, Eileen said.
But he plays with enthusiasm, Greer continued. He enjoys it, doesn't consider it wasted time. He's no klutz on the athletic field. He gets along fine with his mates. He's not introverted or emotionally dysfunctional in any way. Luke is your basic, moderately cool American kid wearing rock band tees and his cap around backward. He might not be that cool in an ordinary school. The daily trudge might drive him crazy. But I think even there, he'd be okay. He'd just pursue his studies on his own. He added hastily, not that you'd want to road test that. No, we're happy with him here, Eileen said. Very. And we know he's a good kid. We love him like crazy. And he loves you. I've had several conversations with Luke, and he makes that crystal clear. To find a child this brilliant is extremely rare. To find one who's also so well-adjusted and well-grounded, who sees the outward world as well as the one inside his own head, is even rarer. If nothing's wrong, why are we here? Herb asked. Not that I mind hearing you sing my kid's praises, don't get that idea. And by the way, I can still beat his ass at horse, although he's got a decent hook shot. Greer leaned back in his chair. The smile disappeared. You're here because we're reaching the end of what we can do for Luke, and he knows it. He's expressed an interest in doing rather unique college work. He would like to major in engineering at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology in Cambridge and in English at Emerson across the river in Boston. What? Eileen asked. At the same time? Yes. What about the SATs? It was all Eileen could think of to say. He'll take them next month in May at North Community High, and he'll knock the roof off those tests. I'll have to pack him a lunch, she thought. She'd heard the cafeteria food at North Comm was awful. After a moment of stunned silence, Herb said, Mr. Greer, our boy is 12. In fact, he just turned 12 last month. He may have the inside dope on Serbia, but he won't be able to even raise a mustache for another 3 years. I understand how you feel, and we wouldn't be having this conversation if my colleagues in guidance and the rest of the faculty didn't believe he was academically, socially, and emotionally capable of doing the work, and yes, at both campuses. Eileen said, I'm not sending a 12-year-old halfway across the country to live among college kids old enough to drink and go to the clubs. If he had relatives he could stay with, that might be different, but... Greer was nodding along with her. I understand. Couldn't agree more, and Luke knows he's not ready to be on his own, even in a supervised environment. He's very clear-headed about that. Yet he's becoming frustrated and unhappy with his current situation, because he's hungry to learn. Famished, in fact. I don't know what fabulous gadgetry is in his head. None of us do. Probably old Flint came closest when he talked about Jesus teaching the elders. But when I try to visualize it, I think of a huge,
gleaming machine that's running at only 2% of its capacity, 5% at the very most. But because this is a human machine, he feels hungry.
Frustrated and unhappy? Herb said. Huh, we don't see that side of him.
I do, Eileen thought. Not all the time, but sometimes, yes. That's when the plates rattle or the doors shut by themselves. She thought of Greer's huge, gleaming machine, something big enough to fill 3 or even 4 buildings the size of warehouses, and working at doing what, exactly? No more than making paper cups or stamping out aluminum fast food trays. They owed him more. But did they owe him this?
What about the University of Minnesota? She asked. Or Concordia in St. Paul? If he went to one of those places, he could live at home.
Greer sighed. You might as well consider taking him out of the broad and putting him in an ordinary high school. We're talking about a boy for whom the IQ scale is useless. He knows where he wants to go. He knows what he needs.
I don't know what we can do about it, Eileen said. He might be able to get scholarships to those places, but we work here, and we're far from rich.
Well now, let's talk about that, Greer said.
2.
When Herb and Eileen returned to the school that afternoon, Luke was driving around in front of the pickup lane with 4 other kids, 2 boys and 2 girls. They were laughing and talking animatedly. To Eileen, they looked like kids anywhere. The girls in skirts and leggings, their bosoms just beginning to bloom. Luke and his friend Rolf in baggy cords, this year's fashion statement for young men, and T-tops. Rolf's read, "Beer is for beginners." He had his cello in its quilted case and appeared to be pole dancing around it as he held forth on something that might have been the spring dance or the Pythagorean theorem. Luke saw his parents, paused long enough to dap Rolf, then grabbed his backpack and dove into the back seat of Eileen's 4Runner.
"Both peas," he said. "Excellent. To what do I owe this extraordinary honor?"
"Do you really want to go to school in Boston?" Herb asked. Luke was not discomposed. He laughed and punched both fists in the air.
"Yes! Can I?"
Like asking if he can spend Friday night at Rolf's house, Eileen marveled. She thought of how Greer had expressed what their son had. He'd called it global, and that was the perfect word. Luke was a genius who had somehow not been distorted by his own outsized intellect. He had absolutely no compunctions about mounting his skateboard and riding his one-in-a-billion brain down a steep sidewalk hell-bent for election. "Let's get some early supper and talk about it," she said.
"Rocket pizza," Luke exclaimed. "How about it? Assuming you took your Prilosec, Dad, did you?"
"Oh, believe me, after today's meeting, I'm totally current on that."
3. They got a large pepperoni, and Luke demolished half all by himself, along with 3 glasses of Coke from the jumbo pitcher, leaving his parents to marvel at the kid's digestive tract and bladder as well as his mind. Luke explained that he had talked to Mr. Greer first because,
"I didn't want to freak you guys out. It was your basic exploratory conversation."
"Putting it out to see if the cat would take it," Herb said.
"Right, running it up the flagpole to see who'd salute it. Sticking it on the 515 to see if it gets off at a diner. Throwing it against the wall to see how much..."
"Enough." He explained how we might be able to come with you.
"You have to," Luke said earnestly. "I'm too young to be without my exalted and revered mater and pater. Also..."
He looked at them from across the ruins of the pizza.
"I couldn't work. I'd miss you guys too much."
Eileen instructed her eyes not to fill, but of course they did. Herb handed her a napkin. She said,
"Mr. Greer, laid out a scenario, I guess you might say, where we could possibly..." "Well..."
"Relo," Luke said.
"Who wants this last piece?"
"All yours," Herb said. "May you not die before you get a chance to do this crazy matriculation thing."
"Ménage à collage," Luke said, and laughed.
"He talked to you about rich alumni, didn't he?" Eileen put down the napkin.
"Jesus, Lukey, you discussed your parents' financial options with your guidance counselor? Who are the grown-ups in this conversation? I'm starting to feel confused about that. Calm down, Mamacita. It just stands to reason. Although my first thought was the endowment fund. The broad is a huge one. They could pay for you to relocate out of that and never feel the pinch, but the trustees would never okay it, even though it makes logical sense.
It does? Herb asked.
Oh, yeah. Luke chewed enthusiastically, swallowed, and slurped Coke. I'm an investment. A stock with good growth potential. Invest the nickels and reap the dollars, right? That's how America works. The trustees could see that far, no prob, but they can't break out of the cognitive box they're in.
Cognitive box? His father said.
Yeah, you know, a box built as a result of the ancestral dialectic. It might even be tribal, although it's kind of hilarious to think of a tribe of trustees. They go, if we do this for him, we might have to do it for another kid. That's the box. It's like handed down.
Received wisdom, Eileen said.
You nailed it, Mom. The trustees will kick it to the wealthy alumni, the ones who made mucho megabucks thinking outside the box but still love the old Broderick blue and white. Mr. Greer will be the point man, at least I hope he will. The deal is, they help me now, and I help the school later on, when I'm rich and famous. I don't actually care about being either of those things. I'm middle class to the bone, but I might get rich anyway as a side effect, always assuming I don't contract some gross disease or get killed in a terrorist attack or something.
Don't say things that invite sorrow, Eileen said, and made the sign of the cross over the littered table.
Superstition, Mom, Luke said indulgently. Humor me and wipe your mouth. Pizza sauce. Looks like your gums are bleeding.
Luke wiped his mouth.
Herb said, according to Mr. Greer, certain interested parties might indeed fund a relocation move and fund us for as long as 16 months.
Did he tell you that the same people who'd front you might be able to help you find a new job?
Luke's eyes were sparkling.
A better one? Because one of the school's alumni is Douglas Finkel. He happens to own American Paper Products. And that's close to your sweet spot, your hot zone, where the rubber meets the roof.
Finkel's name actually came up, Herb said, just in a speculative way.
Also, Luke turned to his mother, eyes bright. Boston is a buyer's market right now when it comes to teachers. Average starting salary for someone with your experience goes 65,000.
Son, how do you know these things? Herb asked.
Luke shrugged. Wikipedia to start with. Then I traced down the major sources cited in the Wikipedia articles. It's basically a question of keeping current with the environment. My environment is the Broderick School. I knew all of the trustees. The big money alumni had to look up.
Eileen reached across the table, took what remained of the last pizza slice out of her son's hand, and put it back on the tin tray with the bits of leftover crust.
Lukey, even if this could happen, wouldn't you miss your friends?
His eyes clouded.
Yeah, especially Rolf. Maya, too. Although we can't officially ask girls to the spring dance, unofficially she's my date. So yeah. But,
they waited. Their son, always verbal and often verbose, now seemed to struggle. He started, stopped, started again, and stopped again.
I don't know how to say it. I don't know if I can say it.
Try, Herb said. We'll have plenty of important discussions in the future, but this one is the most important to date. So try. At the front of the restaurant, Richie Rocket put in his hourly appearance and began dancing to Mambo No. 5. Eileen watched as the silver space-suited figure beckoned to the nearby tables with his gloved hands. Several little kids joined him, boogieing to the music and laughing while their parents looked on, snapped pictures, and applauded. Not so long ago, 5 short years, Lukey had been one of those kids. Now they were talking about impossible changes. She didn't know how such a child as Luke had come from a couple like them. Ordinary people with ordinary aspirations and expectations. And sometimes she wished for different. Sometimes she actively hated the role into which they had been cast, but she had never hated Lukey and never would. He was her baby, her one and only.
Luke, Herb said, speaking very quietly.
Son?
It's just what comes next, Luke said.
He raised his head and looked directly at them,
his eyes lighted with a brilliance his parents rarely saw. He hid that brilliance from them because he knew it frightened them in a way a few rattling plates never could. Don't you see? It's what comes next. I want to go there and learn and then move on. Those schools are like the Broad, not the goal, only stepping stones to the goal.
What goal, honey? Eileen asked.
I don't know. There's so much I want to learn and figure out. I've got this thing inside my head. It reaches, and sometimes it's satisfied, but mostly it isn't. Sometimes I feel so small, so damn stupid.
Honey, no, stupid is the last thing you are.
She reached for his hand, but he drew away, shaking his head. The tin pizza pan shivered on the table. The pieces of crust jittered.
There's an abyss, okay? Sometimes I dream about it. It goes down forever, and it's full of all the things I don't know. I don't know how an abyss can be full. It's an oxymoron, but it is. It makes me feel small and stupid, but there's a bridge over it, and I want to walk on it. I want to stand in the middle of it and raise my hands.
They watched, fascinated and a little afraid, as Luke raised his hands to the sides of his narrow, intense face. The pizza pan was now not just shivering, but rattling, like the plates sometimes did in the cupboards.
And all those things in the darkness will come floating up.
I know it. The pizza pan skated across the table and banged on the floor. Herb and Eileen barely noticed. Such things happened around Luke when he was upset. Not often, but sometimes. They were used to it.
I understand, Herb said.
Bullshit he does, Eileen said. Neither of us do. But you should go ahead and start the paperwork. Take the SATs. You can do those things and still change your mind. If you don't change it, if you stay committed,
she looked at Herb, who nodded,
we'll try to make it happen.
Luke grinned, then picked up the pizza pan. He looked at Richie Rocket.
I used to dance with him like that when I was little.
Yes, Eileen said. She needed to use the napkin again.
You sure did.
You know what they say about the abyss, don't you? Herb asked.
Luke shook his head, either because it was the rare thing he didn't know, or because he didn't want to spoil his father's punchline.
When you stare into it, it stares back at you.
You bet it does, Luke said. Hey, can we get dessert?
4. With the essay included, the SAT test lasted 4 hours, but there was a merciful break in the middle. Luke sat on a bench in the high school's lobby, munching the sandwiches his mother had packed for him and wishing for a book. He had brought Naked Lunch, but one of the proctors appropriated it, along with his phone and everyone else's, telling Luke it would be returned to him later. The guy also riffled through the pages, looking either for dirty pictures or a crib sheet or two. While he was eating his snackimals, he became aware of several other test takers standing around him. Big boys and girls, high school juniors and seniors.
Kid, one of them asked, what the hell are you doing here?
Taking the test, Luke said, same as you.
They considered this. One of the girls said,
are you a genius, like in a movie?
No, Luke said, smiling, but I did stay at a Holiday Inn Express last night.
They laughed, which was good.
One of the boys held up his palm, and Luke slapped him 5.
Where are you going? What school?
MIT, if I get in, Luke said, which was disingenuous. He had already been granted provisional admission to both schools of his choice, contingent on doing well today, which wasn't going to be much of a problem. So far, the test had been a breeze. It was the kids surrounding him that he found intimidating. In the fall, he would be in classes filled with kids like these. Kids much older and about twice his size. And of course, they would all be looking at him. He had discussed this with Mr. Greer, saying he'd probably seem like a freak to them. It's what you feel like that matters, Mr. Greer said. Try to keep that in mind. And if you need counseling, just someone to talk to about your feelings, for God's sake, get it. And you can always text me. One of the girls, a pretty redhead, asked him if he'd gotten the hotel question in the math section.
The one about Aaron? Luke asked.
Yeah, pretty sure I did.
What did you say was the right choice? Can you remember?
The question had been how to figure how much some dude named Aaron would have to pay for his motel room for X number of nights if the rate was $99.95 per night, plus 8% tax, plus an additional one-time charge of $5. And of course, Luke remembered because it was a slightly nasty question. The answer wasn't a number. It was an equation.
It was B. Look.
He took out his pen and wrote on his lunch bag. 1.08 parentheses 99.95x end parentheses plus 5.
Are you sure?
She asked.
I had A.
She bent, took Luke's bag. He caught a whiff of her perfume, lilac,
delicious,
and wrote parentheses 99.95 plus 0.08x end parentheses plus 5.
Excellent equation, Luke said. But that's how the people who make these tests screw you at the drive-thru.
He tapped her equation.
Yours only reflects a one-night stay. It also doesn't account for the room tax.
She groaned.
It's okay, Luke said. You probably got the rest of them.
Maybe you're wrong and she's right, one of the boys said. It was the one who'd slapped Luke 5. She shook her head.
The kid's right. I forgot how to calculate the fucking tax. I suck.
Luke watched her walk away, her head drooping. One of the boys went after her and put an arm around her waist. Luke envied him. One of the others, a tall drink of water wearing designer glasses, sat down next to Luke.
Is it weird? He asked. Being you, I mean.
Luke considered this.
Sometimes, he said. Usually it's just, you know, life.
One of the proctors leaned out and rang a handbell.
Let's go, kids.
Luke got up with some relief and tossed his lunch sack in a trash barrel by the door to the gym. He looked at the pretty redhead a final time, and as he went in, the barrel shimmied 3 inches to the left. 5. The second half of the test was as easy as the first, and he thought he did a passable job on the essay. Kept it short, anyway. When he left the school, he saw the pretty redhead sitting on a bench by herself and crying. Luke wondered if she'd bricked the test, and if so, how badly. Just not going to get your first choice badly, or stuck with community college badly. He wondered what it was like to have a brain that didn't seem to know all the answers. He wondered if she'd accept comfort from a kid who was still your basic pipsqueak. She'd probably tell him to make like an amoeba and split. He even wondered about the way the trash can had moved. That stuff was eerie. It came to him, and with the force of a revelation, that life was basically one long SAT test. And instead of 4 or 5 choices, you got dozens, including shit like some of the time and maybe so, maybe not. His mom was waving. He waved back and ran to the car. When he was in and belted up, she asked him how he thought he'd done.
Aced it, Luke said.
He gave her his sunniest grin, but he couldn't stop thinking about the redhead. The crying was bad, but the way her head drooped when he pointed out the mistake in her equation, like a flower in a dry spell, had somehow been worse. He told himself not to think about it, but of course you couldn't do that. Try not to think of a polar bear, Fyodor Dostoevsky once said, and you will see the cursed thing come to mind every minute.
Mom?
What?
Do you think memory is a blessing or a curse?
She didn't even have to think about it. God only knew what she was remembering.
Both, dear.
6. At 2 a.m. on a morning in June, while Tim Jameson was night-knocking his way up Dupre's Main Street, a black SUV turned onto Wildersmoot Drive in one of the suburbs on the north side of Minneapolis. It was a crazy name for a street. Luke and his friend Rolf called it Wildersmoot Drive, partly because it made the name even crazier and partly because they both longed to smooch a girl, and wildly. Inside the SUV were a man and 2 women. He was Denny. They were Michelle and Robin. Denny was driving. Halfway along the curving, silent street, he shut off the lights, coasted to the curb, and killed the engine.
You're sure this one isn't TP, right? Because I didn't bring my tinfoil hat.
Ha ha, Robin said, perfectly flat. She was sitting in the back seat.
He's just your average TK, Michelle said. Nothing to get your undies in a bunch about. Let's get this thing going.
Denny opened the console between the two front seats and took out a cell phone that looked like a refugee from the 90s. Blocky, rectangular body and short, stubby antenna. He handed it to Michelle. While she punched in a number, he opened the console's false bottom and took out thin latex gloves, two Glock Model 37s, and an aerosol can which, according to the label, contained Glade air freshener. He handed back one of the guns to Robin, kept one for himself, and passed the aerosol can to Michelle.
Here we go, big team, here we go, he chanted as he gloved up. Ruby red, that's what I said.
Quit the high school shit, Michelle said.
Then into the phone, crooked against her shoulder so she could put on her own gloves.
Simons, do you copy?
Copy, Simons said.
This is Ruby Red. We're here. Go on and kill the system.
She waited, listening to Jerry Simons on the other end of the call. In the Ellis home, where Luke and his parents slept, the DeWalt alarm consoles in the front hall and the kitchen went dark. Michelle got the go-ahead and gave her teammates a thumbs up.
Okay, all set.
Robin slung the go-bag, which looked like a medium-sized lady's purse, over her shoulder. No interior lights went on when they exited the SUV, which had Minnesota State Patrol plates. They walked single file between the Ellis house and the Destin house next door, where Rolf was also sleeping, perchance to dream of smooching wildly, and entered through the kitchen. Robin first, because she had the key. They paused by the stove. From the go-bag, Robin brought out two compact silencers and three sets of lightweight goggles on elastic straps. The goggles gave their faces an insectile look, but rendered the shadowy kitchen bright. Denny and Robin screwed on the silencers. Michelle led the way through the family room into the front hall, then to the stairs. They moved slowly, but with a fair amount of confidence along the upstairs hall. There was a rug runner to muffle their steps. Denny and Robin stopped outside the first closed door. Michelle continued to the second. She looked back at her partners and tucked the aerosol under her arm so she could raise both hands with the fingers spread. Give me 10 seconds. Robin nodded and returned a thumbs up.
Michelle opened the door and entered Luke's bedroom. The hinges squeaked faintly. The shape in the bed, nothing showing but a tuft of hair, stirred a little, then settled. At 2 in the morning, the kid should have been dead to the world, in the deepest part of his night's sleep, but he clearly wasn't. Maybe genius kids didn't sleep the same as regular ones. Who knew? Certainly not Michelle Robertson. There were two posters on the walls, both daylight visible, viewed through the goggles. One was of a skateboarder in full flight, knees bent, arms outstretched, wrists cocked. The other was of the Ramones, a punk group Michelle had listened to way back in middle school. She thought they were all dead now, gone to that great Rockaway beach in the sky. She crossed the room, keeping mental count as she did so. 4, 5. On 6, her hip struck the kid's bureau. There was a trophy of some kind on it, and it fell over. The noise it made wasn't loud, but the kid rolled onto his back and opened his eyes.
Mom?
Sure, Michelle said. Whatever you want. She saw the beginnings of alarm in the boy's eyes, saw him open his mouth to say something else. She held her breath and triggered the aerosol can 2 inches from his face. He went out like a light. They always did. And there was never a hangover when they woke up 6 or 8 hours later. Better living through chemistry, Michelle thought. And counted 7, 8, 9. On 10, Denny and Robin entered Herb and Eileen's room. The first thing they saw was a problem. The woman wasn't in bed. The door to the bathroom was open, casting a trapezoid of light on the floor. It was too bright for the goggles. They stripped them off and dropped them. The floor in here was polished hard wood, and the double clack was clearly audible in the silent room.
Herb? Low from the bathroom.
Did you knock over your water glass?
Robin advanced to the bed, taking her Glock from the waistband of her slacks at the small of her back while Denny walked to the bathroom door, making no attempt to muffle his footfalls. It was too late for that. He stood beside it, gun raised to the side of his face. The pillow on the woman's side was still indented from the weight of her head. Robin put it over the man's face and fired into it. The Glock made a low coughing sound, no more than that, and discharged a little brown smut onto the pillow from its vents. Eileen came out of the bathroom looking worried.
Herb, are you all...
She saw Denny. He seized her by the throat, put the Glock to her temple, and pulled the trigger. There was another of those low coughing sounds. She slid to the floor. Meanwhile, Herb Ellis's feet were kicking aimlessly, making the coverlet he and his late wife had been sleeping under puff and billow. Robin fired twice more into the pillow, the second shot a bark instead of a cough, the third one even louder. Denny took the pillow away. What, did you see The Godfather too many times? Jesus, Robin, his head's halfway gone. What's an undertaker supposed to do with that? I got it done. That's what matters. The fact was, she didn't like to look at them when she shot them, the way the light went out of them. You need to man up, girl. That third one was loud. Come on. They picked up the goggles and went down to the boys' room. Denny hoisted Luke into his arms. No problem there. The kid didn't weigh more than 90 pounds. And gave his chin a jerk for the women to go ahead of him. They left the way they had come, through the kitchen. There were no lights on in the adjacent house, even the third shot hadn't been that loud, and no soundtrack except for the crickets and a faraway siren, maybe all the way over in St. Paul. Michelle led the way between the two houses, checked the street, and motioned for the others to come ahead. This was the part Denny Williams hated. If some guy with insomnia looked out and saw three people on his neighbor's lawn at 2 in the morning, that would be suspicious. If one of them was carrying what looked like a body, that would be very suspicious. But Wildersmoot Drive, aimed after some long-gone Twin Cities bigwig, was fast asleep. Robin opened the SUV's curbside back door, got in, and held out her arms. Denny handed the boy in, and she pulled Luke against her, his head lolling on her shoulder. She fumbled for her seatbelt.
Ugh, he's drooling, she said.
Yes, unconscious people do that, Michelle said and closed the rear door. She got in the shotgun seat and Denny slid back behind the wheel. Michelle stowed the guns and the aerosol as Denny cruised slowly away from the Ellis house. As they approached the first intersection, Denny put the headlights back on. Make the call, he said. Michelle punched in the same number. This is Ruby Red. We have the package, Jerry. Airport ETA in 25 minutes. Wake up the system. In the Ellis home, the alarms came back on. When the police finally arrived, they would find 2 dead, 1 gone, the kid the most logical suspect. He was said to be brilliant, after all, and those were the ones that tended to be a little wonky, weren't they? A little unstable. They'd ask him when they found him, and finding him was only a matter of time. Kids could run, but even the brilliant ones couldn't hide. Not for long. 7. Luke woke up, remembering a dream he'd had. Not exactly a nightmare, but definitely of the not-so-nice variety. Some strange woman in his room, leaning over his bed with her blonde hair hanging around the sides of her face. Sure, whatever you want, she'd said, like a chick in one of the porno clips he and Rolf sometimes watched. He sat up, looked around, and at first thought this was another dream. It was his room, same blue wallpaper, same posters, same bureau with his Little League trophy on it. But where was the window? His window looking out at Rolf's house was gone. He shut his eyes tight, then sprang them open. No change. The windowless room remained windowless. He considered pinching himself, but that was such a cliche. He popped his fingers against his cheek instead. Everything stayed the same. Luke got out of bed. His clothes were on the chair, where his mom had put them the night before. Underwear, socks, and t-shirt on the seat, jeans folded over the back. He put them on slowly, looking at where the window should have been.
then sat down to put on his sneakers. His initials were on the sides, L-E, and that was right, but the middle horizontal stroke of the E was too long. He was sure of it. He turned them over, looking for street grit, and saw none. Now he was completely sure. These were not his sneaks. The laces were wrong, too. They were too clean. Nevertheless, they fit perfectly. He went to the wall and laid his hands against it, pressing, feeling for the window underneath the wallpaper. It wasn't there. He asked himself if maybe he'd gone crazy, just snapped, like a kid in a scary movie written and directed by M. Night Shyamalan. Weren't kids with high-functioning minds supposed to be prone to breakdowns? But he wasn't crazy. He was as sane as he'd been last night when he went to sleep. In a movie, the crazy kid would think he was sane. That would be the Shyamalan twist. But according to the psychology books Luke had read, most crazy people understood they were crazy. He wasn't. As a little kid, 5 as opposed to 12, he'd gone through a craze of collecting political buttons. His dad had been happy to help him build his collection, because most of the buttons were really cheap on eBay. Luke had been especially fascinated, for reasons he could not explain, even to himself, with the buttons of presidential candidates who had lost. The fever had eventually passed, and most of the buttons were probably stored in the attic crawl space or in the cellar, but he had saved one as a kind of good luck talisman. It had a blue plane on it, surrounded by the words, "Wings for Wilkie." Wendell Wilkie ran for president against Franklin Roosevelt in 1940, but lost badly, winning only 10 states for a total of 82 electoral votes. Luke had put the button in the cup of his Little League trophy. He fished for it now and came up with nothing. Next, he went to the poster showing Tony Hawk on his birdhouse deck. It looked right, but it wasn't. The small rip on the left-hand side was gone. Not his sneakers, not his poster, Wilkie button gone, not his room. Something began to flutter in his chest, and he took several deep breaths to try and quiet it. He went to the door and grasped the knob, sure he would find himself locked in. He wasn't, but the hallway beyond the door was nothing like the upstairs hallway in the house where he had lived his 12-plus years. It was cinder block instead of wood paneling. The blocks painted a pale industrial green. Opposite the door was a poster showing 3 kids about Luke's age running through a meadow of high grass. One was frozen in mid-leap. They were either lunatics or deliriously happy. The message at the bottom seemed to suggest the latter. "Just another day in paradise," it read. Luke stepped out. To his right, the corridor ended in institutional double doors, the kind with push bars. To his left, about 10 feet in front of another set of those institutional doors, a girl was sitting on the floor. She was wearing bell bottoms and a shirt with puffy sleeves. She was black, and although she looked to be Luke's own age, give or take, she seemed to be smoking a cigarette.
8. Mrs. Sigsby sat behind her desk, looking at her computer. She was wearing a tailored DVF business suit that did not disguise her beyond lean build. Her gray hair was perfectly groomed. Dr. Hendricks stood at her shoulder. "Good morning, Scarecrow," he thought, but would never say.
"Well," Mrs. Sigsby said, "there he is, our newest arrival, Lucas Ellis. Got a ride on a Gulfstream for the first and only time and doesn't even know it. By all accounts, he's quite the prodigy."
"He won't be for long," Dr. Hendricks said, and laughed his trademark laugh, first exhaled, then inhaled, a kind of hee-haw. Along with his protruding front teeth and extreme height, he was 6'7". It accounted for the tech's nickname for him, Donkey Kong. She turned and gave him a hard look.
"These are our charges. Cheap jokes are not appreciated, Dan."
"Sorry," he felt like adding, "but who are you kidding, Siggers?" To say such a thing would be impolitic, and really, the question was rhetorical at best. He knew she wasn't kidding anyone, least of all herself. Siggers was like that unknown Nazi buffoon who thought it would be a terrific idea to put Arbeit macht frei, work sets you free, over the entrance to Auschwitz. Mrs. Sigsby held up the new boy's intake form. Hendricks had placed a circular pink sticky in the upper right-hand corner.
Are you learning anything from your pinks, Dan? Anything at all?
You know we are. You've seen the results.
Yes, but anything of proven value?
Before the good doctor could reply, Rosalind popped her head in.
I've got paperwork for you, Mrs. Sigsby. We've got 5 more coming in. I know they were on your spreadsheet, but they're ahead of schedule.
Mrs. Sigsby looked pleased.
All 5 today? I must be living correctly.
Hendricks, a.k.a. Donkey Kong, thought, you couldn't bear to say living right, could you? You might split a seam somewhere.
Only 2 today, Rosalind said. Tonight, actually, from Emerald Team, 3 tomorrow from Opal, 4 are TK, 1 is TP, and he's a catch. 93 nanograms BDNF.
Avery Dixon, correct? Mrs. Sigsby said. From Salt Lake City.
Orem,
Rosalind corrected.
A Mormon from Orem, Dr. Hendricks said and gave his hee-haw laugh.
He's a catch, all right, Mrs. Sigsby thought. There will be no pink sticker on Dixon's form. He's too valuable for that. Minimal injections, no risking seizures, no near-drowning experiences, not with a BDNF over 90.
Excellent news. Really excellent. Bring in the files and put them on my desk. You also emailed them?
Of course, Rosalind smiled.
Email was the way the world wagged, but they both knew Mrs. Sigsby preferred paper to pixels. She was old school that way.
I'll bring them ASAP.
Coffee, please, and also ASAP.
Mrs. Sigsby turned to Dr. Hendricks. All that height, and he's still carrying a front porch, she thought. As a doctor, he should know how dangerous that is, especially for a man that tall, where the vascular system has to work harder to begin with. But no one is quite as good at ignoring the medical realities as a medical man. Neither Mrs. Sigsby nor Hendricks was TP, but at that moment they were sharing a single thought.
How much easier all this would be if there was liking instead of mutual detestation.
Once they had the room to themselves again, Mrs. Sigsby leaned back to look at the doctor looming over her.
I agree that young Master Ellis's intelligence doesn't matter to our work at the Institute. He could just as well have an IQ of 75. It is, however, why we took him a bit early. He had been accepted at not 1 but 2 Class A schools, MIT and Emerson.
Hendricks blinked. At 12?
Indeed. The murder of his parents and his subsequent disappearance is going to be news. But not big news outside the Twin Cities, although it may ripple the internet for a week or so. It would have been much bigger news if he had made an academic splash in Boston before he dropped from sight. Kids like him have a way of getting on the TV news. Usually the golly gosh segments. And what do I always say, Doctor?
That in our business, no news is good news.
Right.
In a perfect world, we would have let this one go. We still get our fair share of TKs. She tapped the pink circle on the intake form.
As this indicates, his BDNF isn't even all that high, only...
She didn't have to finish. Certain commodities were getting rarer. Elephant tusks, tiger pelts, rhino horns, rare metals, even oil. Now you could add these special children, whose extraordinary qualities had nothing to do with their IQs. 5 more coming in this week, including the Dixon boy. A very good haul. But 2 years ago, they might have had 30.
Oh, look, Mrs. Sigsby said.
On the screen of her computer, their new arrival was approaching the most senior resident of front half.
He's about to meet the too smart for her own good Benson.
She'll give him the scoop, or some version of it. Still in front half. Hendricks said. We ought to make her the goddamn official greeter. Mrs. Sigsby offered her most glacial smile.
Better her than you, Doc.
Hendricks looked down and thought of saying, From this vantage point, I can see how fast your hair is thinning, Siggers. It's all part of your low-level but long-running anorexia. Your scalp is as pink as an albino rabbit's eye. There were lots of things he thought of saying to her. The grammar-perfect, no-tits chief administrator of the Institute. But he never did. It would have been unwise.
9. The cinder block hallway was lined with doors and more posters. The girl was sitting under one, showing a black boy and a white girl with their foreheads together, grinning like fools. The caption beneath said, I choose to be happy.
You like that one?
The black girl said. On closer inspection, the cigarette dangling from her mouth turned out to be of the candy variety.
I'd change it to I choose to be crappy, but they might take away my pen. Sometimes they let shit slide, but sometimes they don't. The problem is that you can never tell which way things are gonna tip.
Where am I? Luke asked. What is this place? He felt like crying. He guessed it was mostly the disorientation.
Welcome to the Institute, she said. Are we still in Minneapolis?
She laughed.
Not hardly, and not in Kansas anymore, Toto. We're in Maine, way up in the Willywags. At least according to Maureen, we are.
In Maine? He shook his head as if he had taken a blow to the temple.
Are you sure? Yep. You're looking mighty white, white boy. I think you should sit down before you fall down.
He sat, bracing himself with one hand as he did so, because his legs didn't exactly flex. It was more like a collapse.
I was home, he said. I was home, and then I woke up here, in a room that looks like my room, but isn't.
I know, she said.
Shock, isn't it?
She wriggled her hand.